The greatest accomplishment in human history happened by obscurity. As Jesus hung on the cross, the irony was clear. He was innocent, but he was treated as guilty. He claimed to be a king, but he was condemned as a criminal. He claimed to know the way to life, but his life came to an abrupt end. He claimed to be equal with God, but at his hour of greatest need, God abandoned him. He claimed to save others, but in the end, he could not save himself. Everything that Jesus said and did was undone in 6 hours, but what appeared to be a failure was, in fact, the greatest victory. By dying as innocent, he could acquit the guilty. By dying unjustly, he could remove us from God's judgment. By giving up his life, he could give us life. By being abandoned by God, he ensured that we would never be left alone. By refusing to save himself, he saved everyone. After Jesus had died, he was placed in a tomb to be forgotten forever. People thought Jesus was just another false messiah, another failed revolutionary. And for 2 days, they could have been right. But on the third day, something happened that removed all doubt. The tomb was empty. Jesus had risen. His resurrection from the dead proved, once and for all, that Jesus was no mere mortal. He was who he said he was. God became man.
All right, happy Easter, Traders Point. It's good to see you. It's good to see you here at the 8 o'clock. You guys awake? All right, I think we should do 8 o'clock every week. What do you think? No? All right, maybe. All right. One excited person over here. Hey, between the 4 and the 6 o'clock last night, we had 43 baptisms, so that's something to celebrate on Easter. Praying for a lot more today. And want to welcome anybody who may be watching online as well. And man, if this is your first time to be with us, man, we're really, really glad that you're here, regardless of maybe the reasons or the circumstances surrounding how you got here today. Because I realize that maybe some of you got invited by a friend and you didn't want to be rude and turn them down, so you came. Some of you lost a bet. All right, some of you, mom threatened your very life, or maybe the girl that you're dating kind of threw down an ultimatum, and so here you are. All right, so man, really glad though that you could be here. And if you've got a Bible, go ahead and grab it and get to John chapter 20. That's where we are today. And if you don't have a Bible, please stop by Connection Central on your way out. We'd love to give you a Bible just as our gift to you. But over the past several months together as a church, we've been studying John's gospel. And you probably are aware of this. At the beginning of the New Testament, it starts off with three books, the names of four men, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These are known as the gospels. And what they are the written records of Jesus' life, his ministry, and his actions. And they were designed to be written in such a way that would help us to get to know Jesus better. And as a church, we've been taking months to study through John's gospel. We've not been rushing it. And one of the reasons why we picked John's gospel specifically is because John was known as the disciple that Jesus loved, which is a pretty cool title. See, if you think about it, Jesus had 12 men that followed him around everywhere for 3 years, and then out of those 12 men, there were three that Jesus had kind of a special friendship with, Peter, James, and John, and then out of those three, John is the only one that is described as the disciple that Jesus loved, which just simply means that they very easily could have maybe just been best friends, that there was just this deep connection between Jesus and John, and so John knew some things about Jesus that the rest of us need to know. In fact, at the very end of John's gospel, he says, you know what, I've given you all this stuff about Jesus. John's gospel is about 21 chapters long. But then he says, you know what? Jesus did a whole bunch of other stuff, and he said a whole bunch of other things that if we were to put them in books, we wouldn't have enough books in the world to contain it all, which is hyperbolic language to basically say, Jesus did a whole bunch of other stuff that I saw that I didn't necessarily record in this gospel. But everything that I have put in this gospel is so that you may believe. And so we've been studying John's gospel because we believe that John's got some really good information that we need to know. See, here's the thing that's been happening in the life of our church, is that we just want to know Jesus better than we do. We want to know Jesus better than we think we do, and we want to know better Jesus than we used to know him. And so we've just been working through John's gospel, believing that we're going to get to know Jesus better by listening to John's words about who he was. So here's the thing. If you don't normally come to church, or if you've been away from church for a while, maybe you have really good reasons for not coming to church every week. Maybe you had a bad church experience at some time in your past. Maybe a priest or a pastor let you down in a big way. Maybe you live next door to kind of a condescending, judgmental, evangelical type, and you're like, man, if that's what Christians are, then no thank you. I don't want to have anything to do with that. Maybe for some of you, you're like, I know what science says, and I know what the Bible says, and I'm having a hard time reconciling the two, so I don't think that that's for me. And I want you to know that that's not insignificant or unimportant, those issues. What I would ask of you today, though, is if you could maybe just kind of set them off to the side. Not do away with them, not eliminate them. You can come back to them. Could you just set them off to the side and ask yourself this question? How well do I know Jesus really? Like, how well do I know him? Do I know him better than I used to? Do I know him better than I thought that I did? Do I really know what Jesus said and who he said he was and who he says that I am? And so if you're willing to go there, then the very natural question that we'll ask is, can I trust Jesus or not? See, most of the time, whenever we talk about faith or religion or things that are spiritual, we'll say things like this. Well, I believe in God or I don't believe in God. I am a Christian or I'm not a Christian. I go to church or I don't go to church. But I want to phrase it this way. Do you trust Jesus or not? Do you trust that he is who he says that he is and that he'll do what he says that he'll do? So when Jesus comes along and he says, this is a better way to live your life, this is actually the life that I died to give to you, do you believe him or not? In fact, John even says that Jesus came to give us life to the fullest. And so Jesus either knows what he's talking about or he doesn't. Maybe Jesus has this full life that we're all looking for and we all need and we all want, but we haven't been able to find because it can only be found in him and through him and when we trust him. So do you trust Jesus or not? See, the churchy way of saying that is, do I have faith in Jesus? And so the answer to that is either yes or no. It can't be maybe. The answer is not somewhere in the middle. And the reason why is because the faith that Jesus offers and the faith that we are all looking for sounds like this. Faith is living your life with confidence that Jesus is who he says that he is, and he will keep every promise that he's ever made to you. See, oftentimes when you hear the word faith, you immediately compartmentalize it to that spiritual part of your life. And you say, well, faith is for when I die. Faith is for Sunday when I come to church and sing some religious songs and listen to some guy drone on and on for several minutes about some obscure Bible passage. And then I'll go on and I'll live my real life when it starts on Monday morning. But that's not what faith is. Faith is living your everyday real life with confidence. And how many of you are like me? There have been seasons and stretches of your life where you lived your life with insecurity, and you've lived your life in fear, and you've lived your life where I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but faith is living your everyday real life with confidence that Jesus is who he says that he is, and he'll keep every promise that he's ever made to you. And you may say, what promise has Jesus ever made to me? Well, that's why we've been studying John's gospel, because there's a whole bunch of promises in there. And Jesus says, here's what I promised you, and here's what I'm going to do. And so faith basically boils down to, when it comes to all these decisions and all these choices that we make in our everyday lives, the lead domino in all of that comes down to the fact, do I have confidence in Jesus that he is who he says that he is, and he will do what he says that he will do? So regardless of whether or not you realize it, every decision and every choice that you make throughout your life is largely a reflection of what you believe about Jesus. You either trust him or you don't. And you may say you trust him, but your actions will betray you. Your thoughts will betray you. And so do you trust Jesus? Now here's the thing. Many of us in this room, maybe even especially those of us who grew up in church, were kind of sold a false version or a cheap substitute of Jesus. In other words, we were given this impression, or maybe even we were told, this is who Jesus is, and that's not really who Jesus is. And when it comes to cheap substitutes or bad versions of the real thing, it's always a bummer. I remember when I was growing up as a kid, I was a big fan of Dr. Pepper, all right? Anybody else a Pepper in the room? Do you have the t-shirt? A few of you, all right? I don't drink it much. In fact, I can't even remember the last time I had a Dr. Pepper, but when I was a kid, I loved it. And every now and then, my mom would come home. In order to save a buck, she'd come home with the cheap substitute, Dr. Zipper, all right? And I was like, Mom, this is not the real thing. And she's like, of course it is. And I'm like, no, it's not. I grew up I was a kid in the late 80s and early 90s. I was a big fan of the Chicago Bulls, and I love Michael Jordan. Therefore, I loved his shoes. I remember the first year the Air Jordans came out, and I was like, Mom, can I have a pair of those? And she's like, how much are they? And they're like, $65. And she's like, no way, right? Every single year when the new Jordan came out, I would ask, and they would always tell me no, and they would say, they're too expensive, and you're not good enough at basketball for that, right? And so I grew up and never had a pair of Jordans, and several months ago, I was online, and I saw that they make every single pair of Air Jordans, like the vintage ones, every single year. They still make them, and they sell them, and eBay, like they're really, really expensive. But I found this website. It was like called cheapshoes.com, which should have like tipped me off. But I'm not very bright, all right? And so I was on the website, and they have every single Air Jordan that go all the way back to the beginning, and they were like $80. And I found my favorite pair of Jordans. I think it was the 4s. And I was like, man, those are the ones that I really, really want. And you know what? I'm an adult now. And Mom and Dad aren't here to tell me no. But I got to figure out how to do this without my wife finding out. And so I clicked on the order form, and I got the $80 Jordans, and I ordered them, and they were coming from China, all right? So like 4 weeks go by, and I don't. They took my money, but I'm not getting anything. And so I sent them an email, like, where are the shoes? And 2 weeks later, I finally get another email. It's in broken English, and it said, shoes on boat, must wait longer. I was like, this is not good, all right, this is not. They finally came in this beat up cardboard box, and man, they were fakes, bad plastic, it was awful, and I was so let down. Cheap substitutes and bad versions of the real thing will always leave you with a bad taste in your mouth, and many of you have been given a version of Jesus. You see, here's the thing. If you buy into a bad version of Jesus, you'll buy into or put up with a bad version of just about everything else in life, including a bad version of yourself. And what I mean by that is you can't possibly know who you are and your value and your worth and what God thinks about you and make any sense of this life until you understand who Jesus Christ is. See, if you buy into what is a bad version of Jesus? Well, there's usually one of two that's going around. One is either he was the Mr. Rogers of Palestine, kind of like this nice, wimpy, kind of a nerdy kind of a guy that walked around, blonde hair, blue eyes, pale skin, never mind, he was a Jew who lived in the Middle East, all right? And he had like a blue sash, and he walked around just asking people, would you please go to church and stop sinning and all that, and just really, really wimpy. Or Jesus is really, really irritated with you. He's hovering over your shoulder, and he just can't wait to smash you and catch you in a sin. Bad versions of Jesus. Jesus has neither one of those things. He is grace and truth. He's come. One of the things I want you to see all through John's gospel, it says these things have been written so that you'll come to believe. These things have been written for your joy. And we're going to see a word that Jesus uses over and over again in this passage, and it is the word peace. And what I love about Jesus is that he seems to understand how you and I might be skeptical of him. He seems to understand that it may be difficult for us to put our trust in him because you put your trust in a person at some time in your past and they let you down. You put your trust in a person who actually spoke in the name of Jesus and they let you down. And Jesus is like, I get that. So every time you get around Jesus, he's going to point to an event. He says, I'm going to point to an event, and that event will show you that I am who I say that I am, that I can be trusted, and that I will keep all of my promises to you. See, the big difference between Jesus and every other religious figure and mystical guru that has ever walked the face of this planet is an event. See, there are other religious leaders who taught very similar things to Jesus. I mean, it's not like a novel thought to say, hey, you just need to love one another. Like, people other than Jesus have said that. What sets him apart from others is an event. That Jesus would say, I'm going to go to a cross, and I'm going to be beaten, and I'm going to be put to death. I'm going to die. I'm going to go into a grave, and then I'm going to defeat death on your behalf. And some of you may be like, why? Why the crucifixion? Why did he have to be murdered in that way? Why so gruesome? Well, because it's a picture of how devastating my sin, pride, and rebellion really are to God and to other people. It's an illustration of what sin does to our relationships with God and with others. And Jesus said, I'll go to that cross, and I'll take my perfect righteous record, and I'll transfer it to your account. You see, the resurrection changes everything. It just does. Like, if the resurrection didn't happen, what we're doing right now is stupid. You didn't expect to hear that today, did you? Like getting up at 7 in the morning or 6:30 or whenever you got up and coming to an 8 o'clock service, this is a colossal waste of time if the resurrection didn't happen. You should just walk away and never feel guilty about ever coming to Easter services ever again. But if it did happen, then it changes everything. If it did happen, then we should probably gather together more than just on Easter. If it did happen, it means that Jesus deserves our total submission and our total trust, not for our enslavement, but for our joy. And the one thing that I love about the Bible is that it's honest about the fact that some people really struggle to believe resurrection. And I get it, man. People don't die and come back to life. But Jesus did. And Jesus is like, look, man, if you're skeptical of that, I totally get it. And so let me tell you about some other people that were skeptical of it. Let me tell you about some other people that really struggled to put their confidence in Jesus as well. See, here's the thing about the Bible. If resurrection was all made up, the Bible would have communicated it in a very, very different way. The Bible would have communicated it in such a way so that there would be no way for you to have any sort of doubt about it. Like it would have said, Jesus went to a cross, he went into a grave, and then the disciples gathered around the tomb, and they started counting down, 10, 9, 8, and the stones started to roll away, 3, 2, 1, and this bright light, and Jesus comes out like a WWF with like the belt, you know, and they're all like, way to go, Jesus, that was so rad, that was an awesome magic trick you did. But that's not how it's communicated at all, and I want to take a look at a passage of Scripture that gives us these details that don't sound made up. In fact, they sound intellectually honest, to help us put our trust in Jesus. So chapter 20, starting in verse 1. You ready? Gonna work through this? You don't seem very ready. That's all right. Hey, I just want you to know, if I'm a little amped up, it's because I got to do this like 3 more times. All right, so thanks for hanging in. Starting in verse 1, here we go. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, that's John, the one whom Jesus loved. Notice how he worked that in there, right? And I would too. I'd have the t-shirt made up. I am the disciple who Jesus loves, all right? So they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So understand this. Mary goes to the tomb at the crack of dawn as early as she could to check on Jesus' body. Now, the reason why is because they had to rush to get Jesus' body in a tomb. The Sabbath was coming, and they couldn't do any work on the Sabbath, including burying somebody. And so they rushed to get it done. They put Jesus in a borrowed tomb. Notice the irony of that. Jesus didn't even have his own gravesite, right? It was Joseph of Arimathea, who's a wealthy guy who followed Jesus, and he said, hey, Jesus can be buried in my tomb. How eerie is that? God would be buried in a tomb meant for you. And so Jesus was put into this tomb, and Mary is really worried about it all weekend. She's like, you know what? I don't think they got his body prepared right, and so the first chance that she can get, she's gonna go to the tomb, and she's gonna check on Jesus' body, and if it's not been properly prepared for burial, she's gonna do that. Mary is not going to the tomb expecting resurrection at all. That's not what she's expecting. She's still expecting Jesus to be there. But when she gets there, she sees an empty tomb. But notice she doesn't go, oh, he must have resurrected. Instead, she assumes something else. She assumes somebody either stole his body, or they misplaced his body, or they moved his body, and I didn't get the message. And so she's worried about it. But she is the first person to discover the empty tomb. Now, here's the thing. Is that if this was made up, they wouldn't have had a woman discovering the tomb for the first time. The reason why is because a woman's testimony in the first century wouldn't hold up in court. Now, I'm not saying that's right. In fact, that's wrong. But that's the way that it was in that society. And so if you were making it up, if you were John and you were wanting to kind of pull one over on everybody, you would say, why not John be the first one to discover the empty tomb? He was, after all, the disciple that Jesus loved, but that's not what happened. It was Mary. So go on in verse 3. So Peter went out with the other disciple, that's John, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. That's a nice little humble brag, John. Like the other, it's like, could you just imagine Peter later reading the Gospel of John? He's like, what? Right? John, I thought we were just having like a nice little jog. I didn't know you were turning it into a competition, all right? And so verse 5, stooping to look in, he, what's the word there? Saw. He saw it. He saw the linen clothes lying there. And notice again, it says he stooped to look in. Get this, the stone was not rolled away so that Jesus could get out. The stone was rolled away so that witnesses could see in. It's not that Jesus like was resurrected, then he's like, oh great, how am I gonna get out of here? Right? I don't have any cell phone reception in here, all right? No, the stone is rolled away so that they could see in, and that's exactly what happens. He sees the linen clothes lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him, apparently out of breath, all right, and went into the tomb, and he, what's the word? Saw the linen clothes lying there and the face cloth, which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen clothes, but folded up in a place by itself. Now, listen, why give that kind of detail if you're making it up? I mean, if you're a guy just kind of making this up, there's no way you'd give that kind of detail. You'd just be like, oh, and the linen clothes were like over in the corner. But he's describing what he saw. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, John, let it go, all right? We know you run like a gazelle, all right? We get it, all right? Also went in and, what's the word? Saw and believed. They saw and believed. But notice verse 9. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. What I want you to see is that the end of verse 8, the beginning of verse 9, it says they saw and they believed, for they did not yet understand the scriptures. There's hope for us. Have you ever read the Bible and been like, man, I'm utterly confused. I don't know what this is talking about. Every time I try to read the Bible, I fall asleep. I feel like I have to know this whole thing before I can put my trust in Jesus. But according to this, these guys saw and believed before they fully even understood the scriptures. And on what was the basis of their belief? It was a person. They had confidence in Jesus. Let's keep going. Verse 11. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. So apparently, Mary ran back to the tomb as well. John didn't mention that. My theory is that she outran them both, all right? And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." This is fascinating. Mary still is not thinking resurrection. It's not even crossed her mind. She's still thinking that they've misplaced Jesus' body, and I've got to find it. Verse 14, having said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing, but she did not know that it was Jesus. And I think it's because she wasn't expecting to see him. She wasn't looking for him. And notice how Jesus just kind of subtly appears into the narrative here. Like if I was Jesus, I would have had some sort of grand entrance. I would have had like a spotlight. I would have had trumpets. I would have had doves or something. But Jesus just kind of appears to her. And in verse 15, Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away," in other words, if you've taken Jesus' body, "would you please just tell me where you've laid him? And I will take him away." In other words, "I will go and I'll look after him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And I think that's how he would have had to have said it. Like he just looks at her, "Mary." See, if you've been here in this series, a few weeks ago, we covered that chapter where it says that the sheep understand, they recognize the voice of the shepherd. And Jesus looks at Mary and he calls out her name, and that's when she recognizes it. And she turned and said to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father, and now your Father.'" How can he say that? Well, because of resurrection. This is intimate language. He's not just my Father, but he's your Father, to my God and your God. And Mary Magdalene went and announced it to the disciples, "I've seen the Lord," and that he had said these things to her. Verse 19, on the evening of that day, the first day of the week, the doors being locked where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, even so I am sending you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you withhold forgiveness from any, it is withheld." What's happening here? Well, the disciples, even after Mary had said to them, "I've seen the Lord," they are behind locked doors. That is not a posture of confidence. That is a posture of fear. They're afraid of what happened to Jesus is getting ready to happen to them because of their allegiance to him. And so they are behind locked doors. Now get this, Mary has already said to them that she has seen Jesus alive, but they are behind locked doors, which means what? They didn't buy it. They didn't believe her. They're like, Mary, you're highly emotional. You're hallucinating. You've seen some things. Mary, I think you're just seeing what you want to see. And they're ducked up behind these closed doors. And notice in the passage, it just says that Jesus kind of beams in like Star Trek style. Like he didn't knock on the door. They didn't open it up. He's just there. It's kind of like, it just reminds me of like a Monty Python movie, right? Like they're all huddled around and Jesus just appears behind them. And he's like, who are we looking for? And the guys are like, we're looking for Jesus. Like, oh, what's he look like? Kind of like you. What? And so you just see this, and the first words out of Jesus' mouth are what? It's what we're all looking for. Peace. Hey, you guys are afraid right now. You're not living your life with confidence. You're fearful. You're insecure. You don't know what's going to happen, but peace be with you. Now, Thomas wasn't there. We don't know where he was, but he wasn't there that day, and Thomas is probably the one that you are familiar with, you've heard about, because Thomas has earned this real unflattering nickname. He is known as what? Doubting Thomas. That's like the ultimate bummer, right? It's like, can you just imagine that's your nickname? Hey, nice to meet you, Doubting Bradley, right? And it's just like that's gonna stick with you forever. I would imagine Thomas is in heaven right now going, when is that going to wear off? Because I'm not the only one that doubted, all right? But he's the one that got stuck with it, and Thomas wasn't there. And look what it says in verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. They said the exact same thing to Thomas that Mary had said to them. But he said to them, unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe. I love the fact that they've included this in this passage. It just rings true that there were some skeptics among them, even those who knew Jesus personally, even those who had walked with him. And maybe you can relate to Thomas's words here. See, the testimony of Thomas's friends was not enough for him. He's like, you know what? I'm not gonna believe just because you say so. I need to see him, and I need to put my hands in his scars. And maybe some of you, as you're sitting here today, you're like, you know what, Aaron? I really don't care what you say, and I don't care how passionately and convincingly you say it. I believe you believe it, but I'm not buying it. You see, the only way that I'll believe is if God does, and you fill in the blank. See, some of us are like, the only way I'll believe is if God heals my mom. The only way I'll believe is if God gives my dad a job. The only way I'll believe is if God would just bring some peace to the Middle East. The only way I believe in God is, and what is it for you? Now notice, Thomas has just thrown down this challenge, and look at what it says in verse 26. 8 days later, that just jumped out at me this last week as I was studying this passage. I was like, you, really? Like Thomas has just thrown out this challenge. The only way I'm gonna believe that Jesus is alive is if I see him and touch his scars, and then Jesus waits a week, longer than a week. If I was Jesus and I knew that Thomas had said that, guess the first place I'm going. I'm finding out where Thomas is. And I'm gonna walk in and I'm gonna be like, hey Thomas, heard you talking trash. Hey, bam, all right? Believe now, sucka, all right? I mean, I don't think Jesus would have said that. I don't know how you translate sucka into Aramaic, but I would have said it, all right? And so, but Jesus waits 8 days. That's amazing to me. See, what that teaches us is that God is not on your timetable and he is not on mine. I have friends who are atheists, and we'll get into conversations about God and about faith, and one of their favorite questions is to just say this. They'll just say, Aaron, we know that you believe and you know, and all that, you're a pastor and everything, but what would it take to get you to not believe in God? What would it take to get you to walk away from your faith? And that answer is easy. It's if the resurrection didn't happen. If the resurrection didn't happen, I'm out. But I'll always turn the tables on them and I'll say, well, what would it take to get you to believe? What would it take to get you to put your faith in God? And they'll always say something like this. Well, if God would just do this. If God would just speak to me in an audible voice right now. Well, he didn't. So obviously he doesn't exist, doesn't care, or doesn't have the power to. And the major flaw in that kind of thinking is that we are asking God to play by our rules, go along with our logic, see things from our perspective, and move along our timetable. And the one small problem with that is that he's God. That would kind of like be if like a little kindergartner came up to you sometime today, and in their squeaky little voice, they wagged their finger in your face, and they said, "I don't believe you can drive a car." I can tell you what you're not going to do. You're probably not going to go, "Come here, you little squirt," you know, and come out in the parking lot. You stand right there on the curb. "I'm going to show you I can drive a car." And you get in, you start it up, and you put it into drive, and you're like, "See, look at that, right? Believe, sucker," all right? You know, you're not going to try to prove yourself to a little kindergartner. You have more confidence in yourself than that. No, no, odds are you're just going to smile, and you're going to pat them on the head, and you're going to say, "You are so cute. All right, run along now and try not to poop your pants." Listen, God is not up in heaven wringing his fingers with worry over how he is going to prove to you that he exists. He's just not. In fact, if he was, he's not the kind of all-powerful God worth serving. He's just a dog, and you say, "Go do that trick so that I believe in you." And God is not about doing magic tricks to prove to you or to convince to you that he exists. See, God is not insecure. God does not have a low self-esteem. He is sovereign. He is all-powerful. He is kind. He is gracious, and he is good. Look at what it says in verse 26. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them now. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came in and stood among them, beamed in Star Trek style once again, and said to them, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, now put yourself in Jesus' sandals. What would you say to Thomas? Like if I was in Jesus' shoes and Thomas had followed me around for 3 years and Thomas doubted even after the disciples had said they'd seen me and even after Thomas had been around everything that Jesus had said and done, I think that what I would say to Thomas is, "Thomas, dude, what gives, bro? Like, what do I have to do to prove myself to you? You really don't believe in me?" But Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus says to him, "Hey, Thomas, peace, peace. Put your finger here and see my hands. And put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, Thomas, but believe." And Thomas answered him, the only fitting reply, "My Lord and my God." Here's what I want you to see. If Jesus could be that patient and that kind and that compassionate to Thomas, who had seen him face to face and had placed his hands in the scars of Jesus' side, how much more patient and kind and compassionate do you think that Jesus would be with you and you've never seen him physically and you don't have the opportunity to touch his scars? Like, it'd be so awesome if I could like arrange a personal appearance of Jesus on Easter weekend. That'd be awesome. Like right after the service, like, "Hey, on your way out, Connection Central, grab a Bible." And then Jesus will be over here making an appearance. You can go up, you can talk to him, you can touch his scars, and you can ask for one thing, but keep the line moving because there's others who want to see him. That you could leave here on Easter weekend going, "I saw him, it's done. My faith is wrapped up for a while." But Jesus actually says to Thomas, "Hey man, you know, put your hands in my side," and he is kind and he is compassionate with him. And this leaves us with the question, how much more kind and compassionate would he be with us who've never seen him? We don't have to imagine because Jesus addresses that. Verse 29, he says to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me?" In other words, he's like, that's not too hard. "But blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Who's he talking about there? He's talking about me. He's talking about you. It's like, look, Thomas, there's going to come a weekend, Easter, Traders Point, 2015. A whole bunch of people are going to gather, and they don't have the opportunity to see me in person and hear from me and touch my scars, and they're going to believe by the power of my spirit, and they're blessed for it. So you'll often hear us say this around here, that this is a safe place for you to belong before you even believe. I think a lot of times people don't understand that. They feel like if they have got to come to church, it's because they've got to believe first, then they can come to church. They got to get their life together, then they can come to church. But see, this is a place where you can track whatever it is from your life in behind you. You can bring your baggage in with you. You can bring your questions in with you. If you're skeptical, that's fine. You are welcome here. Just come. You don't have to buy everything that I'm saying. In fact, I don't expect you to. Otherwise, you're probably just not thinking. I want you to wrestle it out, and I want you just to be with us as we work our way through through the scriptures. I don't want you to be religious. I don't want you to just write off your intellect. I want you to say, you know what? I'll come for a while and I'll just try to get to know Jesus better. And here's the thing that'll happen. Jesus will change you. See, most of the time we're like, well, let me come to understand and believe the truth, then I'll come to Jesus. It didn't work that way. You come to Jesus first with all of your doubts and all of your questions, and then Jesus helps you to understand. Because it's always personal. That's the way it was with Thomas. So John concludes with this. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples. I would love to know what he did. And we won't find out until the other side of eternity. Which are not written in this book, but these are written. In other words, these 21 chapters that I've given you have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, because that's all that really matters anyway, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. And why that is so prominent is because John was an old man when he wrote his gospel. He was well into his 90s. He was a teenager when Jesus resurrected from the dead, but he wrote this gospel when he was in his 90s to a Greek intellectual culture that had largely dismissed God. They were skeptics. They said, you know what? What in the world does a Jewish carpenter who walked the plains of Palestine 30 years ago have anything to do with my everyday life today? And maybe you can relate to that sentiment. You're like, you know, listen, Aaron, I believe you believe it, and I'm not necessarily for Jesus. I can't really say I'm against him either. I'm just kind of in the middle. Can I do that? You know, can you just kind of leave me alone and kind of live my everyday life, and then when I need Jesus, I'll call upon him? But the thing is that what Jesus did 2,000 years ago, it does matter to the life that you're living right now. Otherwise, Jesus wouldn't have said what he said in verse 29. You see, what Jesus said was either entirely right or it was entirely wrong. But what it can't be is a little bit right and a little bit wrong. And if he is entirely wrong, dismiss him. Walk away from him. Never feel guilty about it ever again. But if he is entirely right, that should stop us in our tracks. And we should say, you know what? I at least owe it to myself, if I'm going to reject Jesus, that I get to know him first before I reject him. The real Jesus, not a cheap substitute. And if you would at least be willing to open yourself up to say, you know what, I'll take some time and I'll get to know Jesus. Here's the thing. He will forgive you, restore you, redeem you, and yes, he will even change you. But I'm not asking you to come to church. I'm not asking you to be religious. I'm not asking you to sign the card and say, I'm a card-carrying evangelical. I'm asking you to get in close proximity with Jesus. And he'll do what he's been doing for 2,000 years. He'll change you. And I want to show you a video of just a few men in our church who've recently experienced this. So take a look at the screens.
I wasn't raised in church, raised in a great family, very supportive family, but church wasn't in my background. I wasn't exposed to the word. And then as I encountered people, especially getting into college, that Christians or religious folks, I would say I was certainly agnostic, but probably not curious. I was probably an agitator. I liked the debate. And really would press people on, you know, why they felt that way and prove it to me and, you know, what kind of scientific thought process. And as I got a little older, as I met my wife Kimberly, who certainly a Christian, I just became more and more curious. And I think I opened my heart a little bit more to listening. Told myself in the beginning, I'll go to Trader's Point, heard good things, but there's no way I'm going through baptism. I watched those screens and videos and said, there's no chance that's happening. Then I started to encounter some people, and people will hear me say all the time that it takes a village, and I believe that it does, but I also think it takes the right village. You have to be open-minded to listening, but then, you know, that sometimes who you might encounter. You know, I've met a lot of great people in my life. We all have. When you see that, try to find out why. If you're skeptical yourself, what is it about that person? What do you admire about the way they are? And I think oftentimes you're going to peel that thing back, and you're going to identify they know there's more than just what we're doing, the daily grind. I never understood that. I was so focused in on just day-to-day life. You know, the other piece was, and I think you'll hear others say this, the hypocritical Christian. I'm not following other Christians. I'm following Jesus. You know, as much as I love listening to our pastors, but that's not who I'm following. I'm following Jesus. And now I recognize that this is just a small glimpse, and there's so much more ahead.
If somebody told me 3 years ago that I would be fully bought into a church, I would have been baptized, I would be serving at a church and loving it, I would have told them they were nuts. I would have told them there's no chance. I would have told them I'm too stubborn, I'm too set in my ways, I don't need that. I never understood why this whole God thing or this Jesus thing was such a big deal. Because for me, it was a compartment, a relatively small compartment of my life. And I felt like I met certain obligations that I had to. And so that compartment was satisfied. So then I could go and I could live the rest of my life. And Sunday morning, I would give this God thing and this Jesus thing an hour or two. But the rest of the week was for me. I never understood that I needed a relationship. I never desired a relationship. I began to realize that that relationship is the foundation for me personally, and the works weren't the foundation. The relationship was the foundation. And because of that foundation, because of that relationship, I began to want to do the things that I used to look at were just the works that were required to just get through.
You know, my mom tried to convince me pursuing God with my head, not my heart. I had to figure that one out on my own. Each week, I get the opportunity to serve 2 to 5-year-olds. I just finished a storytelling with a 4-year-old about Jesus. She comes up to me afterwards, after they get in line to go back to class. She looked dead smack in the middle of my eye and said, "Is he really that good? Is he like this, like the story you just told me? Jesus, is he like that?" I mean, she hit me in the heart, because I knew at that time it wasn't her dad going to give her that message. It wasn't grandparents. It wasn't class. She was asking James Payne. And she was going to hold me skeptic or authentic. I'm skeptical about politicians, athletes, and it doesn't stop me from going to the game. So these lost people who may or may not know God, may have some bad church experiences, I could totally relate. Parents maybe drug them to church, or maybe it was Easter weekend, Mother's Day, Christmas, and you just want to check off the list and get going. Guys coming to church, they could see me and say, "Man, I'm not like that guy. He's too passionate. He's all in. I'm not like that." I wasn't always like this. What is the very thing that's causing you to have the unbelief? Is it that you think that you can do it yourself? You were hoping that you were going to get a king who would rule over the challenges or problems in your life? Guess what? I tried that. There were problems I was having in life. I thought I could fill this cup and they'd go away. Guess what? They came back and with friends. I know he's Lord. What would you really do if he wasn't? You would hope in something else. And I'm guaranteeing you, I've tried those something else's. So the only thing that has been consistent for me, that hasn't gone empty, that hasn't gone away, is God. He became Lord when I opened my heart and let him in. Every time I dig in the Word, he shows me that he is Lord. He shows me that he is real. I'm learning each week and each day as I'm in that Word who he is. He is Lord, period. If you don't believe me, open that Word up and find out for yourself.
A few years ago, there was a Bible translator in Papua New Guinea who was translating the New Testament into the language that the people spoke there. They didn't have a Bible in their language. And so he spent several years translating the entire New Testament. The day came when he was going to give these Bibles away, so everybody kind of gathered around. They were excited to get it. And there was this one man that walked up to him and to get a Bible, and he said, "I need to be honest with you before I take this. I don't plan on reading it." And the Bible translator's like, well, this seems kind of odd. Why do you want it? I've actually worked pretty hard on this for you to take it and to not read it. And the guy was very honest about it. He said, I don't plan on reading it. I plan on smoking it. He was like, what? Apparently, the pages of the Bible are so thin that if you rip it out, line it with tobacco, roll it up, makes for pretty good smoking paper. The guy said, I'd like to take it and use it for that. The Bible translator is like totally taken aback. Like he's like, I don't know what to do about this. I've never had this strange request. He didn't want to say, no, you can't have a Bible. So he said, thinking quickly on his feet, he said, I'll make you a deal. I'll give you a New Testament and you can smoke it, but you need to read a page before you smoke a page. Sounds like an interesting Bible reading plan, don't you think? Read a page, smoke a page. Read a page, smoke a page. Some of you are like, where are those free Bibles at again? All right. So anyway, he gives the guy a Bible. The guy goes away. Like 2 years go by. He doesn't know what happened to him. He's at like this like gathering in the community 2 years later. And there's like this service that they're doing. And he sees the guy like on the second row. And he's like engaged in worship. His whole demeanor has changed. And so afterwards, he goes up to this guy to find out his story. And the man looks at him beaming. And he says, you know what? I took your Bible and I did what you said. He said, before I smoked a page, I read it. And he's like, so I smoked Matthew. And then I smoked Mark, and then I smoked Luke, and then he said, I started to smoke John, but I got to chapter 3, that part where it says, for God so loved the world, and I met Jesus, and I could smoke no longer. See, I don't know what you brought in here with you. I don't know what you've tried. I don't know what you believe. I don't know what you're skeptical of. I don't know if you've been listening to me for the past 30 minutes and saying, well, you know, you're kind of full of it. And I understand that. I get it. And I'm not asking you to believe just because I'm saying it. I'm asking you to at least open up your heart and say, you know what? I don't know that I've ever really fully given the real Jesus a shot. And I need to at least get into close proximity with him. The way that you get to know the real Jesus is through what John says about him. That's why I would encourage you to just start in the Gospel of John. And you know, over the past several weeks, looking ahead to Easter weekend and knowing that it's just going to be a big weekend, knowing that people maybe that don't often go to church would show up, my prayer is just simply that just in this brief time together, that you would at least crack the door open and say, you know what, I'll at least give Jesus a hearing. I'll at least get into close proximity with him. I'll take some of this baggage that I've got, very legitimate, real, significant problems and hurts, and I'll put it off to the side, and I'll try not to let that pollute the well of what I think about Jesus. Man, if you just were willing to do that today, like that's a victory. That's like an answer to prayer. But maybe some of you have maybe just feel kind of this uncomfortable stirring of the Spirit, like, man, I just kind of feel like there's something that you said that just kind of leveled me out today, and maybe today you need to do something tangible with that. Whether it's just where you are, you just pray and say, Lord, I've been leaning my life up against what I can conclude about it. I've been trying to take the controls, and you know what? I want to lean my life up against you. I want to live my life with confidence that you are who you say you are and that you will keep all of your promises to me. Jesus, take the steering wheel. To take the controls of my life. I trust you in that. Some of you today, maybe you've been religious, maybe you've been Christian in name only, maybe you've been a Christmas and an Easter kind of attender, and that's fine, man, I'm so glad that you're here. But maybe today you'd say, you know what, I have faith in Jesus, but you've never publicly been baptized. And baptism is just a public declaration of your death and resurrection. That you're lowered into a watery grave and you come up as a new creation. And we do baptisms every year at Easter because, man, what a great time for you to experience resurrection power in your life. And I know that some of you are like, being baptized on Easter, like I didn't come today expecting to do that. I'm not dressed for it. And that's why we bought Target and Meijer out of all their underwear. And that's why we have dry clothes in the back so that you can go home dry. But if you feel the stirring of your spirit in your heart to say, you know what, in obedience, you need to trust me. I know you don't have all the answers yet. I know just like Peter and John, you don't understand the scriptures fully yet, but you need to come to Jesus Christ. You need to make a public declaration through your baptism. I would encourage you today to jump up to your feet and start walking before you can talk yourself out of it. And you can walk out of these double doors over here. There'll be people back there to meet you and to talk with you. We had numerous people who last night who were not planning on being baptized who showed up and they responded in obedience. And if you're here today and you're kind of intimidated by that and you're scared by that, just reach over and grab the hand of the person next to you and ask them to come with you. Hopefully you know them. All right. And if you don't, I'm sure they'll go along. All right. They'll offer you moral support. All right. But I just encourage you, if you feel that stirring in your spirit, don't squash it. Don't ignore it. Don't say maybe next week, maybe next month, maybe next year, because the odds are you don't know if that stirring will happen again. Would you just be willing in obedience? If you feel the Spirit of the Lord speaking to you, get up where you are and walk. And so let me pray, and then we're going to stand to our feet, and we're going to worship, and we'll just see who comes. If just one person comes, that's awesome. But we'll keep it open as long as we need. Father, we come to you right now. We thank you for this great word. We thank you for how intellectually honest it is that there were people who knew Jesus personally who struggled to believe. Father, help us to believe. Help us to trust in you. Help us to say, you know what? Before I walk away from all of this for good, I at least owe it to myself to know the real Jesus. And so, Father, I pray that if there's anybody here today that just needs to give their life to you, they need to be baptized. Maybe that just sounds crazy to them. Like, man, I should talk to somebody first. I should think about this more first. I pray that just in obedience, just like the day at Pentecost, people would just respond and trust that your Spirit will be guiding them in that. So we ask this right now in the power of your resurrected name, Jesus Christ. And the church says, amen. Hey, would you stand to your feet and sing as people come out these doors now?